Hi, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Mango Tea Podcast with Jody. Just Jody this time. So we do have a guest, but I'll wait till we get to the guest because I'm really, really excited for this week's episode. Like honestly, I've been waiting to get her on forever. But welcome back. I just want to do Talawa and Marakont really quickly, and then we'll go in. So I'm recording on September 25th, and this past week, the UN has been in New York, and it's where all the girls from all over the world come in and talk about, you know, just like being friends in the sandbox, which they never are. So a quick Talawa Ine Marakont is the Bahamian Prime Minister, Philip Davis, told the entire world that the international financial regulators are practice discriminatory practices against Black, Brown, and former colonies of European states. And everybody knew this. And I think for the one of the first times, or it's, I think it's one of, the, well, not the first time, but I think it's big because I don't think anyone has ever addressed it in a UN address to say that these international financial regulators, they say that they're doing good, but they're not. So the situation right now in the Caribbean is a lot of Caribbean countries are being blacklisted from inclusion in certain like operation frameworks because they say that they're being they're harbors for international criminal organizations like that. When really some of these other EU countries are actually harboring terrorists, money. And all these other things. So it's interesting. It's just very interesting. So one of the things he said is we find it astounding that the $2 to $3 trillion, which is estimated to be laundered in developed countries, are never flagged as causes for concern. And then he said attacks against Black and Brown countries are mounting, and it's affecting the smaller states, essentially smaller Caribbean countries. So what ends up happening is it's harder to do banking in smaller countries. So, for example, in Jamaica, banking in Jamaica is literally the worst thing in the world. It's literally a waste of time. And with more and more financial, I guess, red flags against the country, it makes it harder for locals to do banking. And even like expatriates to do banking as well. So yeah. So I mean, shout out to the Prime Minister of the Bahamas, Philip Davis, for bringing this out. So he gets the Talawa for the week. All right, everyone. So I'm really like we always bring you illustrious guests on Mango Tea Podcast because we give you tea with a slice of mango. But this person right here is super special. I first met her literally on the street when I was half naked in Trinidad and Tobago. And it's been like, we've been friends ever since. Everyone, welcome Simone. Simone, thank you so much for joining the podcast. I'm so happy you decided to say yes.
Hi, Jody. Hi, everyone. I'm Simone Evans. I'm a licensed mental health counselor. And yes, we were having the time of our lives in Trinidad.
Yes.
Make the best of times.
Yeah. And Simone has been like one of the biggest supporters of the podcast, too, which has been really encouraging. And just like the topics, just everything. So thank you. This has been a topic that I've wanted to touch on for a while, generational trauma. And Simone talks about it on social media all the time. So I was like, girl, let's talk about it on the podcast because the people need to know. So I think it's also timely because last week, the Queen Elizabeth II was laid to rest, and during her family represents a history of trauma for Black and Brown people around the world, a quarter of the world's population, which really not really, because I feel like it's probably like three quarters of the world, because our influence goes beyond just our borders and it stretches around the world, and our seasonings stretch beyond the world too. And or cleanliness patterns, which is another story. So intergenerational trauma or generational trauma, It's something that has been, I think, a topic as of recent. And I think social media is a gift and a curse. I didn't know about generational trauma coming from slavery until I was on Twitter one day and they were talking about it. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And then when you delve deeper into things and you look at yourself, you realize that generational trauma from slavery is real. So from what I've gathered, slavery, the legacy of slavery lives within every Black and brown person across the world, and white people too, but the white people see the positive effects of it. So like generational wealth, opportunities for mobilization, upward mobilization, education, health outcomes, good health outcomes, and food security. Whereas Black people, I feel like generational trauma has been studied a lot in the U.S., and there really hasn't been a study done. Well, I haven't seen any studies done outside of the U.S. about the effects of it, because most of these countries, and Simone, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this one, but I feel like most studies are focused in the U.S. because I guess the resources are there, and other colonial countries, they have gone to great measures to whitewash history, where they don't say that they were they engaged in slavery. They say that it was an age of exploration, like in Portugal. So some of the effects that have been left with from slavery include discrimination and oppression, poor negative health outcomes, a lack of self-esteem, persistent feelings of anger, internalized oppression, and that internalized oppression can be colorism, texturism, featureism, et cetera. And an overall like absence of opportunities to access to benefits available in society. Because if you think about it, slavery never really ended in my purview. It rebranded into different things. And that rebranding was discrimination and oppression. So I talk a lot. So Simone, like, what are your, as a licensed, well, everyone listen to it, licensed. She went to school, she got the education, she has the degrees, she is knowledgeable on the subject, and she has a license from a licensing board to treat patients. She is not a guru, she's not a life coach, she did not go to a seminar, she is educated, and she knows what she's talking about. So Simone, what are your thoughts?
Jody, you bring up some really great points, right? So I think as descendants of the diaspora, we get caught up in working and surviving and, you know, just doing what's best for us. But as we start to look at that cobweb, right, like how that effect, how we connect to other people, I think looking at the UK, right, and the death of Queen Elizabeth, the Windrush generation, that's traumatic, right? So you're recruited to this country to help them rebuild and get to a certain place in life. If you watch The Crown, you know, you see bits and pieces of this definitely in that Netflix show, if you weren't, you know, alive during that time, so you don't understand the full impact of it. But then to be told, well, you're not good enough, right? Go back to where you're from. And then, you know, it's not just that, it's the forced detention, the loss of employment, housing, the livelihoods, going back to a country that you haven't lived in for several decades. And that's traumatic. You're having to already have said goodbye in some aspect to the country you were raised in and your culture, and then to go to another country and then being pushed away. We think of trauma on different levels, right? So we can think of trauma on a micro level, right? And we specialize in that, right, as therapists, but also thinking of it on a macro level. So if a country is telling you you're not good enough, then does that not reinforce those negative core beliefs of I'm not good enough because X, Y, and Z happened to me during my childhood, and look now, look what this country is doing to me. See, that's proof that I'm not good enough. And so when we think about trauma, it's a lot of times our childhood wounds, right, that we experience as children, and then we go out into the world, and the world does what the world does, unfortunately. we hit into these barriers. And if we don't do the work to unpack it, right? If we don't do the work to look at things on a macro level, it can reinforce those negative core beliefs, meaning I'm not good enough, I'm not worthy, I'm unlovable, right? So every incident that pops up along our life can reinforce those negative core beliefs, or we can learn to challenge those negative core beliefs. Because that's the beautiful thing about being an adult, right? Okay, we got our degrees, or we're hustling, we got our job, we're in this country trying to make a way. But at some point, we got to sit with ourselves, hopefully, right? And to unpack that trauma that we've been carrying along with us. And I think the vast majority of us have experienced trauma. And I think when we really sit and look at the definition of trauma, that's when you're like, wait a minute. You start seeing it everywhere, right? So when I went to school, yes, we talked about trauma. It didn't really hit me. Like, I got trauma. I understood it. I work with children referred from CPS. In Florida, we call it DCF, meaning the children were abused, they were neglected. I kind of kept going in that direction, but that's like the extreme version of trauma we think about. But I think we got to kind of backtrack and look at the real definition of trauma and how it shows up in everyone's lives.
Okay. So what is what is that definition in your opinion?
Right. So trauma is an emotional response to a terrible event that could be an accident, it could be a crime, a natural disaster, right? Think about African Americans and Katrina. That is traumatic, right? Think about, you know, Jamaicans and how Caribbean people, how we prepare sometimes for the storms. I see people debating on Twitter, oh, y'all didn't have to go buy all that bread and get all that gas. I'm in Florida, so, you know, a storm is headed this way. But for some people, it's life or death because they remember Matthew, they remember Gilbert, they remember these different storms that negatively impacted them. And if you're in certain countries or areas, you know, help is not coming. You know, look at Puerto Rico, you know, help, unfortunately, you're tied to the U.S., but help is not coming to the same way it would come for the continental domestic U.S., unfortunately, right? So we see the macro level of trauma, and then we see how we have to deal with it on a micro level. But I think let's break it down even further. So parents getting a divorce or parents struggling to co-parent their children, that is traumatic, right? Parents with mental health diagnoses, whether it's undiagnosed or not, right? Because back then, you know, even now, we barely know about this stuff. So back then, because I get that, you know, a lot. We didn't have that stuff back then. Did you not have it? Or do you not have the proper diagnosing, the proper treatment, the proper access to it, right? It could be little things, right? It could be I got a dog bite when I was 2 years old, but you are deathly afraid of dogs. You will run out of somewhere. A lot of us are like that, right? But it's so a little bit of fear is that's normal. That's typical, right? We need to have a little fear as humans of heights. We need to have a little fear of bears or dogs. A little bit of fear is a good thing because it keeps us safe. It keeps us alive and to reproduce for the next generation. And when we go back down to the basic level of being a human, a lot of that is, you know, basic hardwired in us to survive. But if you think about things like, you know, if you have a certain health diagnosis and you're often in the hospital, there can be trauma related to that. We're surviving a pandemic, an ongoing pandemic, that is traumatic. There's of course we know the sexual abuse, the physical abuse, which, you know, this is being highly debated right now, but, you know, beating our children, let's talk, we can get to go down that tangent eventually one day, but, you know, conscious parenting, that wave that's coming through that some people, you know, they said, I don't believe in that stuff. Okay, but why do we feel as adults that we should have the power to physically hurt a child to get our points across, right? And then we think about as adults, how do we react, right? In our relationships with romantic friendship, in the feelings we have within our body. Because I think a lot of people think, well, I survived that stuff, so I got through it. It's whatever. My parents did the best they could. That part can be true, right? This is not a blaming session. This is not a go against your culture. You know, they did the best they could. We can sometimes say that. Some people, you know, they find relief in that. But, you know, back in the day, you had a roof over your head. You had food on the table. I was a good parent, right? But now we can look at parenting in a different light. Hopefully we're getting to a place of having more resources where we can say, what does parenting look like if you're not in survival mode?
Okay.
What does friendship look like if you're not in survival mode? Right.
So my question is, from the Atlantic slave trade, right, on Caribbean people, because you are of Jamaican descent, you're on Caribbean people all the time. You know what's happening with a culture. You're connected. What are some ways that we have generational trauma as Caribbean people? Like, what does that look like? I know I mentioned like depression. Well, not discrimination and oppression, but or discrimination and oppression is different from like African Americans or even Africans. What does it look like for the Caribbean diaspora? What does that generational trauma look like?
I think that type of trauma can definitely look like people who are separated sometimes from their families, and they're maybe in another country trying to hustle. And okay, the money is there, but what about community? Right. And okay. So I know New York is different than maybe certain parts. I live in Central Florida, so it's a little different than maybe Miami or Fort Lauderdale. But when you disconnect, and this is a joke that we often say, when you come to the U.S., like it's a different, you know, it's a different set of things here. Right. You might not know your neighbor. Some places, certain, you know, you might not be connected with your culture. That can be difficult for some people to connect with. Mm-hmm. Right. And then although we come from a different background, there's still that African diaspora, there's still the, you know, impacts of racism and colorism. That is a big one. So we can sit here and say, oh, we don't have racism in the Caribbean. I see people say that all the time. Okay. That's not necessarily true, right? Because slavery still existed, right? And all these things. But let's talk about colorism. Let's talk about who's at the top of the hierarchy and who's at the bottom. Who's sitting in jail indefinitely, right? Who's on the fringe parts of our society in the Caribbean? And then how does that manifest as well? I've dealt with it, right? I've dated so many men just talking about this. Come to the U.S., they're immigrants. I'm going to hustle. I'm going to make my money. You know, nothing can stand in my way because I went through all of this stuff to get to this country. I'm saying U.S., it could be Canada, it could be the U.K., right? Or somewhere else in Europe or whatever, wherever your hustle is. So I know a lot of Jamaicans are going to, or Caribbean people are going to Asian countries as well and trying to figure out how to, you know, get stable and figure out their future. But we can sit here and say that, but then look at what happens with different generations, right? Of children or families that are coming out of this, with the hustle. Okay. But then you're slammed with white supremacy issues. You're slammed with, you know, still the impact of colorism. This work culture that we have, grind yourself into the ground. It's not good for our mental health. I want to bring up a point that I'm seeing talked about on social media. I apologize. I don't remember her name, but the Jamaican descent woman who was in California as a travel nurse. I believe she works in ICUs.
Yeah.
All these rumors coming out that she was drinking, she was in drugs. It was about a man. As of now, as of what I've seen, and I could be ignorant to all the details, obviously, but there was no drugs in her system, right? So I was reading an article that said there was a mental break that she had in nursing school, right? And it really profoundly changed her. And then from then she's had really difficult mental health symptoms that she's dealing with, right? And so she is of Jamaican descent. The article was talking about she was from Jamaica. I think she immigrated to the US when she was 10. She's distant with her father. That is trauma, right?
Yeah.
So there's different levels of trauma. Then you go to nursing school, then you have a pandemic. Then you're a travel nurse where you're not even, you're bouncing around. The money is there, right? And people, we love that money and it serves a purpose, right? We need it for it to become stable and to get all our needs met, right? But we're disconnected from our community, right? So then our sister, our brother, they can't really sit there beside us and say, you know what, something's wrong. Or a neighbor that we've known for 25 years, we get disconnected from that. And, you know, we're kind of isolated in this Western society often. So that's why it's so important to connect to community. I know we think therapy sometimes is like laying on a couch and it's something that, you know, white Caucasian people do. But I want us to think of mental health and wealth as something evolving, right? So there's physical movement. I just watched Woman King, right? Talks about trauma in that as well. But they have drumming, you know, the drumming, the ceremony, the of the men and women, girls and boys into these societies, fraternity. You know, it's all connected to each other, but there's definitely ways for us to heal. Negative, body based somatic ways to heal. But we
Wait, did you do something? Pause real quick. Did you do something to your audio? Because it like switched.
No, I might be holding it bad.
Oh, it's better now.
Okay, yeah, I think I was covering it, holding it bad.
Okay. Okay, we're good. We're good. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, I think you bring up a good point about like movies, because like I've also made a conscious decision myself that I will refuse to watch any movies about slavery, any shows about slavery or slaves, or any psychological thrillers. Like, I know there's a new Jeffrey Dahmer movie, and I heard of the name Jeffrey Dahmer. And I knew he was a serial killer. I didn't know like exactly what he did. But like I think through Twitter, shout out to Black Twitter, they've been like giving me a synopsis of it and saying that he targeted black people
Yeah,
and the trauma.
community.
So I'm like visiting relatives and they're like, let's watch the first episode. And I'm like, no, because I know that like those kind of things will trigger
Right,
me
so that's
into
really
a negative
important.
phase.
That's important because I think we need to, one, know our triggers, right? And we need to know our boundaries. So I think it's really easy for us to get caught up in, the Bad Girls Club. I was just talking to like a teenager about this, like the Bad Girls Club and like your For You page on TikTok and Real Housewives and like a lot of conflict and physical violence. And then I think it's really important that we learn our boundaries and we communicate assertively, right? That's part of healing. That's part of evolving and growing. So I realized too, I think I was watching something on Netflix the other, last night, and I was like, this is too much already. The sound, right? So let's backtrack. When we experience trauma, our nervous system, it goes on a little bit of a roller coaster, right? And so our body and our brain is always looking for trauma and to kind of protect us from that trauma. So then we can go into fight, flight, fawn, which is like a deer in headlights, or freeze, in freeze mode. No, I did it wrong. So freeze is the deer. Fawn is like, okay, let me just shrink myself and, maybe the captor or the abusive person will kind of leave me alone because I'm defenseless. I'm kind of showing that side of me. That's my interpretation, right? So our brain and body, when there's trauma, our brain is like has a filing system, and this is just with anything, and that's why sometimes implicit bias, right? It gets people in trouble because your brain, from back being cavemen, our brain is learning to file certain things into a certain folder, right? So when I've worked with people who they experience trauma and their brain is then linking the trauma to something that is not traumatic. Right, so you could have a fear, even a phobia or whatever, that develops based on things that were around you when that trauma occurred. So the classic example is a veteran who was off in a war, and there's gunshots and there's bombs going off and all of that audio and visual reminders of the trauma. They come back into their community and they're supposed to reintegrate, right? Like a perfect little citizen. They struggle often. And that's where we have a classic post-traumatic stress disorder diagnosis, right? So it was typically diagnosed for the returning veterans. But then they started saying, wait a minute, we see it in women survivors of sexual abuse. We're seeing this in children who've been abused, physically abused. So then look around and say, we're seeing this in other areas. So then when you're removed from that traumatic environment and you're in the community now as a veteran or as someone surviving, and then you hear a car make a certain unexpected noise or fireworks, right? Your
Interesting.
body is then being transported back to the feeling like I'm in a war zone. My heart, right? Our heart is racing. We have the energy to run and hide, except we're not at war. And so that looks abnormal in the community, right? But that can occur often.
Yeah, like you know what? That's interesting because like I'm like immediately remembering like again going back to Twitter. Like there was like a meme or something, and it was like, if you see people running, you run too. I feel like that is a trauma response
Yes,
as
but
well.
it's also become adaptive because maybe we should, something is telling these other humans to run, right? And so we have to maybe do that as well. I think there was a study I saw. I love Twitter because you get the mess, you get the drama, you get the superficial, but then you will stumble across these interesting,
Some gems.
right, these interesting articles from specialists, right? So I think through Twitter stumbled across an article that was discussing how there's a difference in the cortisol level, the trauma response level of the African American, I believe that they study African American people, so the Black people, versus the white participants. And so there's this ongoing joke that like, oh, certain people, like what color were they when they're doing certain mountain climbing, and but would they have no harness, and like these really extreme adrenaline pumping kind of activities, which I like to do my zip lining too, but it's zip line, right? It's not, yeah, I'm not climbing Mount Everest without a harness, right? So I do think there's a protectiveness towards us where we're like, wait a minute. our ancestors are out there slaving for hundreds of years. So there's certain things we don't really need to do or experience because there's a protective factor. We're trying to survive, right? Because we didn't have that luxury at one point.
Wow. Interesting. So like knowing that like there's certain things personified through our generational trauma. Cause like I completely get it. Like for me, seeing generational trauma in my family, like the women in my family are very stubborn, very, very stubborn, but also very headstrong and overly independent. Mm-hmm. I see that coming through in myself and even in my nieces as well, where they're very stubborn, very headstrong, and they like to assert themselves and like give themselves like independence. And it took me a while, but I was like, wow, this is a trauma response. And then I thought about like Jamaican society as well. Like it's quote unquote, very like this, I kind of struggled with it. It's patriarchal, mm-hmm. but I feel like Jamaican women are some of the most powerful beings on the planet.
Yeah. I think
mm-hmm. they're very independent and we will make a way out of no way all the time.
Absolutely.
And it took me a while to learn that it's a trauma response.
Yes.
That I saw it, my mother saw it.
Right.
Yeah. So how do we, knowing what we know now, how do we deal with that trauma?
Right. Right. So you set that up beautifully, right? So hyper independence, I've seen this on social media and I agree with it. Hyper independence is a trauma response. And I'm guilty of it myself, right? Because mm-hmm. we can be raised and look around and see certain things and we get things instilled in us. You got to find a way. You got to hustle. You can't depend on certain people. Why is that though? Is it because we haven't had the opportunity to have dependable people around us? Is it because we've had our partners ripped away from us and they're then forced, you know, sold to another plantation to go, you know, breed some next woman and, you know, oh, they're the best, you know, enslaved African on the plantation. So they need to have four or five families because that's a good stock. We got to keep that stock. And like, think about the connection of, I know people could get tired of talking about slavery. It was only a few generations ago. It has negatively impacted the African diaspora's relationships, whether they're on the continent, whether they're in Western societies, whether they're in the Caribbean. This animosity I see on social media between Black women and Black men, I think it's stemming from not only slavery. In the U.S., uh-huh. we have segregation. We have Jim Crow. We have redlining, right? So you can't get a house on the good side of town, right? So then also look at Caribbean people. You're going to immigrate to this Western, you know, U.S., U.K., Canada. You immigrate, but you left your partner back in that country. What does that then do to a family?
Oh my gosh.
If there's a connection, like it's all tied together, right? So
my mind is blown.
Yeah.
My mind is blown. Because I've never thought about like, because I don't know if I've ever told you, but like my mother was telling me I have some like ancestral, right? Like great grandfather, some great grandfather who he in Jamaica, he had, and this is like post-slavery, he had family, he established like four different sets of families before he settled with like my fraternal, maternal like ancestor, and he raised his kids like there. But he had other family members, like he had other families and wives and all that.
Right.
I don't know even if they were wives, other places.
Right.
So like I grew up knowing like Jamaican men, like they be having multiple families, be having multiple kids. Like I have a relative who has currently now he has like 15 kids and counting.
Yeah.
Well, not 15. Last time I saw him, it was 8. So it's probably increased since then, but like the having multiple children and multiple families, I have never made the connection at all to slavery.
I definitely think there was that push, right? And then of not having the man in the house, or whether he's been killed, or he's, you know, his purpose is to be out in the fields and to impregnate the different women, to, mm-hmm. you know, keep producing this high value, high stock of enslaved Africans, right? And we'll talk all we want about ethical non-monogamy, right? We can, that's a separate conversation, but the key word is ethical. So when it's unethical, that is traumatic for the families it impacts. That their father is not present in their lives, or that there's this conflict, or that, you know, the wifey versus the matey, and, you know, that ongoing conversation we have in dance hall. And a lot of it is traumatic and it's chaotic. And then it's like when we get that thrill out of the trauma and the chaos, like in social media and music, that's a trauma response. It's these roller coasters our body likes to go on because it feels normal, we're used to that. It comes from our childhood oftentimes. And I don't want to paint the negative picture. So there can be healing, there can be accountability, right? I do specialize in EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. Really fancy words. These people figured out when you're doing these alternating movements, it can help your brain basically process trauma. And mm-hmm. your body kind of let go of that, right? So then I've also done trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. Specializing that, because I want to put this disclaimer out there. Not every therapist specializes in trauma, right? So you have doctors, then you have gynecologists, then you have dentists, then you have psychiatrists. So you have different specialties within the medical field, and you have different specialties within the mental health field. So when you go through school, you learn about it and it's like, okay, you know, you see it. But then when you start getting more of that training and you start doing your own work, inner self work, you start saying, wait a minute, I'm seeing this pattern so many different places. And so that's where the passion then comes out. It's like, if we could heal this trauma, this baggage that we carry with us to be hyper independent, right? Throw ourselves into our careers, to then be unfulfilled and then maybe unhappy, and then project that onto other people. So how do we interact with our friends and within our family groups? A lot of older Caribbean parents, right? They are very much do as I say, not as I do. I'm the parent, right? And then that is difficult when there's that trauma history, right? There's no apologies. There's no accountability, you know, often. There's no healing going on from like the boomer generation and the silent generation, all those other previous generations. I think millennials and younger, and this is obviously generalizations, but often millennials and younger, we're having this conversation because we have access to social media where these topics are coming about more recently. When I went to school for mental health and psychology, we were not talking about this on social media. That was, that didn't happen.
I've always said this, that social media can be a gift and a curse, especially for Caribbean people, even worse for Jamaican people. I feel like I've learned a lot of the things I've learned over the last couple of years have been through really Twitter. Mm-hmm. And some of the clownery that I have seen has been on Twitter as well. Right. So it's like a delicate balance. Yes,
Twitter, Instagram, the Pink Wall and Dear Dream and all these pages where we get their sus in the mix up, we get the information, but then some of it's like, wait a minute, my therapist brain kicks in and I'm like, this is sad, right? The incident just happened where the girl, the 21-year-old, take what, 21 shots?
Yeah.
Rest in peace to her. But what about your support system? What about your friends? What about somebody stepping in and saying, no, like there is a limit. I love you, so I'm going to put my foot down. Right. So alcoholism, substance abuse, that is a mm-hmm. huge red flag that some type of trauma is going on in the background. I know we love our drinking. We love our Caribbean culture. We love our carnival.
Yeah.
Growing up, you don't offer a man no juice or no water when he comes to your house. You offer him some liquor. Right. So that's that's the Caribbean way of doing things, unless he's super religious. And even if he's religious, a lot of times they want some liquor. Right. But
yeah.
Drinking to a certain level, that's an addiction, and that it causes health concerns down the road, that can be a trauma response because our body is trying to cope, right? And so what coping skills do we see people in our society engaging in? the impulsive sexual behaviors. I'm guilty of it in the past too, so I'm not pointing fingers at nobody. Substance abuse, which especially alcoholism and other drugs, right? Eating, right? So sometimes people have eating disorders undiagnosed. I do think there's a lot of anxiety that we experience, and we think, oh, just Caribbean women are clean. Caribbean women are clean. Caribbean household is clean. Certain levels, it is to the point where it is habitual, is ritualistic. It pushes away your children, your partners, because things have to be in a certain order, and things cannot be out of that order. And
oh my God.
You know, we love to say, oh, Caribbean women are miserable, or people are miserable. And I had to really sit with that one, because I was looking at family members like, wait a minute. So the DSM, the Diagnostics Statistical Manual that we use in the U.S. to diagnose people with mental health disorders, it might not perfectly fit for some people, but I've looked and realized that is anxiety, right? Certain things can be anxiety. It can be OCD, like. It just presents differently in Black people. And I think because of slavery, once again, and because of the food we had access to, or the scraps, or the little type of house we had, right? We learned to take good care of it because it was your one house you built with your own hands, right?
Yeah. But
then you get to the U.S. and what does it look like in the U.S.? I just saw a topic on Twitter talking about hoarding, right? So we can talk about cleanliness. The other end of the spectrum is hoarding. So when you have this history of not just slavery, but colonization, and colorism, and then we'll talk about more recent, the crime and the issues that have happened in the 70s and 80s and the 90s in these Caribbean countries that pushed some people to say, you know what, let me take my chances and move to another country because I don't see opportunities for me here. I'm not light-skinned. Yeah. I don't have the right connection to certain people. I see the conversations on Jamaican Twitter every day. If you do not have the right connect, sometimes you cannot get ahead, unfortunately.
That's right.
Right? And there's a brain drain. The brain drain, yep. When the best of your community are moving away for opportunities and they're disconnected from the community. So then they seek what? Substance abuse, sexual, impulsive sexual behaviors to cope with that disconnect from their community. It's all trauma.
Oh my gosh, I am living. Simone, I'm so glad I brought you on because, like, I know my listeners are like getting this valuable information, but for me, like, so many things that you just mentioned, like the brain drain and like moving. Cause like, I remember when I migrated from Jamaica when I was a teenager, and I'm surprised I like got away with it too. Cause I told my mom one day, I was like, mommy, can I live with my aunt in the States? Like cause I had a green card already. And it wouldn't be anything difficult. Cause I was like, listen, like, I feel like educational opportunities and just like upward mobility opportunities might be better because like what was I in? I mean, I went to a decent high school down there, and I mean, like, you never know what would happen, sure, but I strongly feel like if I had stayed, I would have been a little bit more closed-minded, and I wouldn't have had access to certain things, whereas like when I migrated here, like I was visiting different places in the States, which kind of helped feed my travel addiction. I love to travel. I'm from Spain right now, visiting Italy. So like that's the thing. But like, wow, I think the brain drain piece is really critical and important too, because recently on Twitter, there was a Jamaican Twitter. There was a guy, Peter Issa. He is from the Issa family. They're Syrian immigrants from Jamaica, mm-hmm. from like
the day. Saw that.
And those Syrian immigrants are they're in the top echelons of society from a material level, but from a representation level, that percentage is super duper small. Right. But yet they still have so much power. And he was saying that Jamaicans work harder outside of Jamaica than in Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And I would really love to get him.
that topic apart.
I would love to dig in a little bit deeper, but like I felt like my opportunities on the island were limited. Like my parents, they grew up in very, 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 very rural areas, like bush.
Yeah.
So like for them to get to Kingston and to the city was a lot. And I think that was great for them, but they were so limited in what they could do and how much further they could advance. Both of them eventually left.
Yeah.
And I mean, my mother was a civil servant for the government for over 28 years. And even to like get the process to, sorry, mom, the process of like retirement and like all of that. Like, I remember like my mother working like day, like working like very, very hard, seeing like, cause she was a nurse, seeing like 500 patients in a day without any support. Like, if she was in the US, like that would never happen. And if it did, she'd be a travel nurse making bank.
Right. Or you have some agency you can complain to, you write to this person, to that person. You know, I'm not saying it's better or easy in the US, but there's just regulatory boards and there's like, there's rules and there's like even banking. Look at banking in Jamaica. It's a whole day process.
Yeah. So like, I like that brain drain piece is, I think, is really critical, because like, you see it, like a lot of our friends are immigrants from the island. Either their parents told them to come up or they came up independently, because there, even though the US is what it is, like it's the armpit of the world, there are a lot of opportunities here for people from other countries that have been marginalized or are like outcasted from their societies. Like, I feel like if I was in Jamaica, I would be an outcast. Well, I wouldn't be able to move up because the area that I lived in was considered a ghetto. Mm-hmm. Well, it wasn't the ghetto it was surrounded by the ghetto. It wasn't too cool when I was there. It has become hella ghetto now.
Yeah.
So like, it's like, I guess like regional, like, yeah. I guess it's like code ghetto or like regional, like discrimination.
Yeah.
Like, because of, yeah, where I come from. So yeah, I like that is, you hit the nail on the head with that. So how do we as like a society, as a community, a global community within the diaspora, how do we heal from slavery? What are the process to start that healing process?
I think it's important to look at this healing process from, you know, a macro level and a micro level, right? So the big picture and the personal picture. I think it's really important, like you were talking about earlier, setting boundaries, knowing what your triggers are, communicating assertively, not passively and not aggressively, but assertively. And these are skills you can learn in therapy, right? So I know some people think therapy is, you know, something other people do. Find you a culturally competent therapist. Find you a Caribbean-based therapist, a Black therapist. If you're a man, you feel more comfortable talking to men. I know there's not a lot of male therapists out there. You can find, especially with the pandemic and the shift to telehealth, you can find providers as long as they're licensed in the state that you're in. Speaking about the US, you can find providers that you can talk to them on telehealth platforms. You can do it on your lunch break. You can do it after work. There are sliding fee scales, right? So we can talk about costs, right? Because when you're broke, straight out of college, or straight coming to the country, you don't have a lot of money. Mental health is not a top priority because you need food, you need shelter. That's considered Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If our basic needs are not met, it's hard to then go develop your purpose and your passion and all those other things in life. So then there's large community mental health agencies that have sliding fee scales. I've literally treated clients for free, for pro bono, $3, and then the agency gets funding from the government, state, national, county-wise, right? Jamaica has networks, so they have the JAMHAN, I guess, the Jamaica Mental Health Advocacy Network, right? So just connecting, and I think if you're even not ready for therapy, just start consuming material that's mental health related from people who specialize in the topic, right? So there's lots of books that you can read and just kind of see, you know, what sticks out for you. Podcasts, right? We're doing a podcast right now. There are mental health podcasts where we can start just ruminating a little bit and seeing what things, you know, how they settle with you and how that goes. So I can send some recommendations. I have a few for books. There's this one is written by a Black woman in the U.S. She's a psychologist. It's called Turning Crisis into Clarity by Dr. Patrice Barry. This is a really good book, right? So I think this is the number one book I would recommend because it breaks down trauma, the amygdala, cortisol levels,
It talks about parenting. Even if you're not a parent, it's really important to understand parenting because you were once a child, right? So it's really important to understand how to reparent yourself, how to show up and heal your inner child, and how to also be a better parent and adult for children. Because that's right after futurism, the idea of like healing for future generations, even if you don't have children. There's a really good book on setting boundaries because some of us struggle with this, right? And when we struggle to set boundaries, we're not being authentic to our true self. We're actually doing ourselves a disservice. So Set Boundaries, Find Peace. I love this book. You can use it along with therapy or, you know, by Nidra Tawab. I don't know how to pronounce her last name. Tawwab. She writes a great how-to book on examining your boundaries and setting them, being more consistent with those boundaries. With especially as a millennial, I had to really work on this with my old school Jamaican parents, with yeah. friends, dating people. I really work, right? Boundaries will work so we don't burn ourselves out.
I feel like you should write a book about that.
That's a work in progress, from, right?
From a millennial in the Caribbean diaspora perspective. Mm-hmm.
And then this is the one I call the Bible of Trauma. So this is The Body Keeps the Score by Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. So he's from a Jewish background. So he's also a psychiatrist. And so he talks about the medication, revolution with treatment, and then the Holocaust, how that impacted his dad who survived the Holocaust, and how that looked, you know, a parent who survived the Holocaust, how did that look, right? With that trauma.
I've heard of that book before. I think one of my coworkers mentioned it to me because his dad was a survivor of the Holocaust. Yeah. And I remember him telling me, he's like, yeah, I just read this book and it like changed my life because he grew up in Southern Brooklyn, and a lot of Jewish Holocaust survivors lived there, and they would still have the tattoos. And he was like, yeah, like I didn't realize until reading this book that I have generational trauma because my dad had this serious traumatic incident. Yep. He didn't know how to deal with it. He never got help.
Yeah.
There wasn't help available. Mm-hmm. So some of that trauma got put onto his kid.
Yeah. Yep. I consider the Bible of trauma, as in it a lot of people use it and reference it because not only it talks about trauma, it talks about healing, different healing treatment model. So there's EMDR, which I talked about earlier, neurofeedback, right? There's different ways that we can engage our brain and body to heal. But I tell some people when they're saying therapy doesn't work, have you tried body-based treatments? So I know we like to, you know, go by certain models sometimes and think certain people's water is colder or Kool-Aid is, you know, sweeter, but there is healing in some of the activities that we've done in the past, like with the drumming and the music. I think some people, if their thing is, their vibe is church, that whole, you know, gospel choir and the call and response and the shout and all that stuff, I think can be therapeutic for some people if that's their community, right? Yoga, doing yoga, not the gentrified version, but maybe tapping into some healthy yoga, that movement, because we store that trauma in our bodies.
Can we pause real quick? So you mentioned something about church, and I've always thought that Black churches, and even to go down Caribbean churches, mm-hmm. they are the reason why they are still around today is because of Black women.
I
don't know a lot of like Indian, Afro, Indo-Caribbean people, mm-hmm. but like I know from what I grew up with, like Black Caribbean women support these churches. Yeah. So are you saying that them and their kind of obsession with church is that it's kind of a legacy from?
Well, I think the call and response, right? That was definitely a thing in Africa and within slavery, that call and response between the church members and the choir and the preacher. I do think it can be healing. Yes, we can talk about trauma that happens in the church, right? And that turns a lot of millennials away from the church, right? But I think the praise and worship piece of it, I think that can be therapeutic for some people because it's tapping into community. It's music, it's movement, it's you're seeing other people trying to, because those people in tears, they got some trauma they're going through and they're looking for some salvation, they're looking for some healing, right? So I'm not a big, I'm agnostic. I'm not a super religious person. You know, if you're a Rasta, you go to your Rasta community, you do your drumming circle, you do whatever y'all do, and that can be healing as well, right? So if you're a Muslim, if you're Buddhist, whatever that may look like, meditation and grounding, those are all very helpful ways to ground ourselves when we get escalated or when we're like too low, right? So when we go where we're numb and we're just going through the motions, the lights are on, but nobody's home, that disassociation where we're checking out, that also we need a little bit more tapping in then to get a little bit maybe more active. And I mean, it doesn't say it's a replacement for medication. I'm not anti-medication because I know some people are, but I think I've seen where that movement can be helpful in treating people when we're going to be coping with it. But obviously, we can't just cope, 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 cope. We can't just put a band-aid on a seeping infected wound, right? So you got to eventually go in there and dig it out with a trained professional and get to the root of it. But it's hard to get to the root of it if that's been such a big influence in your life. Some people, they mold their lives around that trauma. You could be a perfectionist, you could be high achieving, but that could still be a form of a trauma response. It's just you get praised for it and society likes that, right? So then we get rewarded until we're burned out.
Wow, that is like literally profound. Because like I've never thought about that before, like it could be a healing or a trauma risk. Wow, like the church. I mean, I feel like we got to do an episode about like dealing with trauma from the church, because, and I feel like especially like a Caribbean church as well, because it harbors such a hugely around people's lives. I think I like me personally, like I grew up in the church. Like when I was in Jamaica, like I went to church every single Sunday, did not miss Sunday school. A lot of like one of my really close friends to this day, we went to the same church together and all that, and like that had a lot of trauma. Like and when I migrated to the States, I was forced to go to church every Sunday. I didn't have the sense as big of a sense of community there, but I was forced down my throat. And now, like I as an adult, I've been like, I'm good, but like I
But I
see it
think
as like that,
the millennials, I think a lot of us that aren't in the church, we're still seeking that community. So I tell people, tap into community, whatever that may look like for you. That could be joining a biking group that bikes a trail once a week, right? That could be, you know, having different groups. You have your cultural group, right? Because I grew up in a rural area of Central Florida, but my parents are Jamaican, right? So I didn't feel like I could fully connect with people here often. So then when I went to FAMU, it was a black college. I loved the experience, and I still sought within that black college. I still sought community within Caribbean people because there was people I could relate to, right? And people I could grow and learn from, as well as learning about the African American community and how much we've, as immigrants, benefited from the sacrifices that African Americans have made in this country, you know, with segregation and the civil rights movement, and all of these other things that they had to endure to kind of pave the way for us to come here and work and make benefits. Yeah, but we have to find ways to tap into community, you know, and just whatever that may look like for you, right? So I think we're in a hyper consumerism state. But that can also be like a way to chase dopamine highs and to feel like we're healing. Solange, she has a really good song where she's just like, everywhere I was going, you know, I'm looking to kind of escape, and I couldn't, you know, I couldn't quite find the healing in those superficial things I was chasing. So I think that's the big task of young adulthood and adulthood is like, okay, you have all these accolades, you've done all these professional things, but where is you got to heal, you got to face, you know, the demons that have come from the past. And I saw somebody, I think a psychologist, frame it like this: like trauma is something that happened to you, but we can evolve from that. It doesn't have to limit us. It doesn't have to keep us, hold us hostage. We really can grow from that and become like the authors of our own story. We can get in the driver's seat of the car and not feel like, you know, life is just happening to us. Like we do have some choices, some autonomy. Because if it was trauma was just, oh, you're traumatized, right? If it was just that big label, then you couldn't heal from it, right? But that's not the case. We definitely can heal. We just have to seek community, seek connection. I think music and culture and food and our therapeutic treatments that we talk about, all of that combination, especially for Caribbean people, especially for Black people, I think that can be really helpful in deciding what is the purpose of our life and that journey that we go on.
Oh, girl. I feel like I've gotten a Sunday sermon today. Thank you. Simone, I really want to thank you for like joining today. Like you, like my mind is literally blown right now and I'm thinking of like a multitude of different things. And I'm jotting down things like to talk about my therapist. Like, girl, we got to get through stuff. But I want to thank you for joining. So if people want to follow, like learn more from Simone, like where can they contact you if they want to?
So I do have a personal Instagram that I use, but I do have a professional Instagram, actually, that I've been neglecting a little bit because life is lifing. But my professional Instagram is Abundance Counseling.
Okay. And I will tag you on all the social media platforms when this is done. Okay. Simone, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
And everyone, you will be on more. I will force you to come on. And to everyone, thank you for listening to us. I know there's so many podcasts around the world that you could be listening to, but you decided to listen to Mango Tea to get your tea with a slice of mango. And we will see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Mango Tea Podcast. And of course, sipping tea with us. Like this episode, download, and most importantly, share. Follow us on all social media at Mango Tea Podcast. And of course, don't forget your mango.
You are listening to the Mango Tea Podcast, where we give you tea with a slice of mango. We are a nonpartisan Caribbean diaspora podcast serving up all the tea on news, culture, and history. This podcast was created for the diaspora to know what's happening in the Caribbean beyond the gossip.